Welcome to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlohm. You'd have to literally have had your head in the sand to not be aware that climate change is one of the major threats to the health and welfare of every living thing on Earth. Major business and insurance corporations, the United States military, and ordinary people like you and I are aware that our warming climate poses an existential threat to our economy, defense, way of life, and the existence of many species of plants and animals around the world, not just the proverbial polar bears that have served as the poster species for this issue. We know we are potentially leaving this as a crisis to future generations, and that's based on climate models. How accurate are they, and what exactly do they tell us? How do we know that they are indeed giving us the basis for predicting the future of our planet's oceanic atmospheric conditions? Joining us to talk about it is one of the world's leading climate scientists who actually works on creating and evaluating those models, Gavin Schmidt. Dr. Schmidt is the director of the Goddard Institute for Space Studies in New York, the same position that was once held by Dr. James Hansen, one of the early seminal leaders who sounded the alarm about how our burning of fossil fuels was going to adversely affect our climate system. Schmidt has also been a powerful voice in countering the climate change denialists that have tried for decades to downplay the dangers of human-induced climate change. Gavin Schmidt joins us from his office in New York City. Gavin Schmidt, welcome once again to Blue Dot.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
You are at the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, and I would like you to start out by telling us, because a lot of our listeners may not be familiar with that particular NASA site. Tell us a bit about it.
Well, we're a NASA site. We're actually an offshoot of the Goddard Space Flight Center, which who has its main campus just outside of DC. But we're in New York City. We're just south of Columbia University, and we work mainly on climate models, so simulations of what's happening in the climate, trying to work out what's going on and why, and then monitoring of how things are changing, whether that's in temperatures or through remote sensing and satellite measurements of what's actually happening as we're going.
And it's also quite famous for being where James Hansen was, right? Did you work with James Hansen?
Yes. So when I got here, he was in charge, and we worked together on building up the model simulations, and then working on things like, you know, the attribution of climate change over the 20th century historical period. And then when he retired, I now occupy his job.
Yeah, and I'm very curious about your journey. I'd like to know a little bit about how you came to be in the position you're in now. When did you first start getting interested in climate change and computer modeling, and how did you wind up there?
So when I was an undergraduate, I was very focused on mathematics, and so I just really loved solving the problems and seeing how everything fit together. And then as I kind of progressed in academia, I ended up doing things that were more and more applied to the real world, and I actually liked the fact that people were interested in what you were doing. And so my PhD involved involved oceans and waves in the ocean. And people were very interested in the ocean and marine mammals, not that that was particularly relevant to what I was actually doing. And then, you know, and then in my postdocs and things, people have, you know, I've kind of moved from more pure modeling to more applied. And, you know, once you start with the ocean, then you start to have to think about the climate, and then you're thinking about the changes of the ocean in the past and in the future, and then you're trying to put all of these things in together. And so I ended up at GIS, where really for the first time, you know, I was involved in models that really tried to take into account all the things that we think of as important, and that's something that we've been working on here now for more than 20 years.
Let's talk about that a little bit, about all of the various inputs you have to do to create a climate model. Let's start out with some of the earliest ones from the 70s. Give us a sense of, you know, what kind of inputs you were using back then, or we were using, Dr. Hansen was using, and how that's evolved to what we have now?
Right. So the first sets of models, when people started thinking about the carbon dioxide problem and climate change, they were very basic. You know, basically they were, you know, how much energy is coming into the system, how much energy is leaving, and what happens very straightforwardly to the energy that's left behind. And so these did not take into account, you know, the weather patterns. They did not take into account ocean circulation, but they did take into account you know, radiation and convection and a little bit of clouds. And then as we progressed, you know, we kept thinking about the same problem, but we started adding in additional factors like the weather, like the oceans, like the land, like the sea ice in the Arctic, like the biology, like the soils and all of these other things that now kind of form these very, very complex models. But there's a very clear line that goes from those simple models that we were using in the 1970s through to more and more complexity in the 1980s and 90s to where we get to today.
And one of the things I really wanted to talk to you about is an article I read by Alan Bias about a journal article that you are associated with. And I believe the lead author was Zeke Hausfather from UC Berkeley. And it's comparing all of these computer models to show how accurate they really are. Can you tell us a bit about that work?
Right. So obviously, if you're making predictions for what's going to happen, people want to know how well your previous predictions have done. And people are asking that for the whole field. They're not asking me particularly. You know, they just want to know, you climate people, how accurate have you been with your, you know, kind of generic predictions over time? And I and Zeke, we'd been doing that kind of a little bit casually, looking at very high profile papers, you know, from the 1980s and 1970s, and said, okay, well, you know, how well did that prediction work out? The ones that we were looking at, the answer was not too bad at all. And then we said, okay, well, let's do a more thorough search. Let's find all of the predictions that we made that are checkable, where the data exists, where, you know, we know enough about what they did to be able to evaluate their prediction appropriately. And so we worked with a couple of graduate students from MIT to put together all of the different predictions that had been made going back to 1970. And there were 17 different sets of predictions that we found. And then we said, okay, well, of those 17 predictions, how well did they do? Now, there's two things that you have to test when you're looking at such a prediction. You have to check, you know, what did they assume was going to happen for the inputs? What did they assume was going to happen for how much carbon dioxide was going to be in the atmosphere, what the sun was doing, what other drivers they included? And then you have to ask, well, did the model itself, the physics of the model, was that correct? And it turns out that we can now assess both of those things independently because we know what actually happened with carbon dioxide and the other greenhouse gases. And we can look at the physics that each of those models had, and we can test those things independently. So when you look at the models, like you just look at their raw predictions, what you found is that like 10 out of 17 of them did a bang on job for what was going to happen between, you know, when they were published and today. And then when you look at, you know, the ones that perhaps overestimated how much carbon dioxide was going to rise or underestimated how much the other forcings were going to change, then you could correct a little bit for that. And then you ended up with 14 out of 17 giving very good predictions. And then when you look back and you look at the ones that didn't give a good prediction, we can actually work out why. You know, one of them gave a very low prediction for what was going to happen. And it turns out that they had missed out a key piece of physics that the other groups had in fact used.
What was that key piece of physics?
It turns out to be related to what happens in the stratosphere. So that's the part of the atmosphere that's above the weather. And they had assumed that that was going to stay the same and not change. But we'd already known, actually since the 1960s, that we expect actually big changes to happen in the stratosphere. And you need to take that into account to get the changes in the lower part of the atmosphere right. And they didn't do that. And so that particular prediction stands out really strongly as being quite wrong because of that one element of the physics that they didn't get right.
Yeah, and the stratosphere is, you know, where the ozone layer is, and lots of interesting interactions going on there. And it's interesting to me, you know, a lot of times, you know, it's some of the mistakes that you learn the most from.
That's exactly right. And we do learn from the mistakes that were made in the past, and it does inform how we do the predictions going forward. So one of the things that people did very early on is that they didn't really take into account enough of the uncertainty in exactly what the drivers were going to be. You know, so often in the, you know, in the 19, even through to the mid 80s, people were just using like one estimate of what the future might hold. But we know that, you know, the future is quite uncertain. You know, the economy is uncertain, technology is uncertain, geopolitics is obviously very uncertain, and those things all play a role in what's going to happen. And so, you know, you don't expect climate modelers to be able to work that out. And so since the 1980s, we've started looking at ranges of scenarios. So, you know, so here's a high-end scenario, here's a low-end scenario, and here's something in the middle that, you know, you hope is going to be somewhere close to what actually happens. But you can still get that wrong because, you know, these things are actually very difficult to predict, you know, decades ahead of time.
Yeah, I wouldn't expect climate modelers to be able to get the Iowa and Nevada caucuses right, for example.
Right, or the signing of the Montreal Protocol to reduce ozone-depleting substances. That turns out to have been the most impactful treaty with respect to climate that there's ever been. And yet, you know, anybody kind of prior to the 1980s would not have expected that to have been signed. In fact, it's still a surprise to me.
Well, I one of the things I'd like to ask you about is that, you know, what I've noticed over the years being a person that's kind of a weather nerd and I enjoy following weather is that our models for predicting weather have improved so dramatically in the last decade. And, you know, we can predict out pretty accurately, you know, for about 10 to 14 days what's going to happen. And people often will confuse, you know, what has happened in the past with, oh, somebody got a forecast model wrong, or, you know, they weren't in agreement or whatever. Can you compare for us the differences, the major differences between a weather model, you know, what's going to happen with your specific weather in a place like where I live in Northern California over the next 7 to 10 days, and climate, because it's, you know, it's a whole different ballgame. You're talking about a much longer timescale. My understanding is that it's actually, in some senses, easier to get a climate prediction right than it is to just, you know, nail weather over 14 days.
So that's a great question. So as you rightly said, the skill in weather forecasts has been improving enormously over the last 20, 30 years, as both the computation and our understanding of the system has improved, but also, you know, the amount of data that we're bringing in from satellites and observations is increasing, and our ability to understand what that data is saying is also increasing. So those are the core reasons why the weather forecasts have been getting better. But the skill of weather forecasts comes about because, you know, we can track, you know, individual things in a turbulent flow, like a big weather system. You know, we can see it move with the westerlies, or we can see an El Nino event kind of changing convection patterns in the Pacific. And then we can see the waves kind of coming off that. You're looking at the flow in all of its detail, and you're trying to kind of predict, you know, where this eddy is going to go, or where that filament, that atmospheric river, for instance, is going to land. And after a while, it becomes too difficult. It's a chaotic process. And in fact, it doesn't matter how accurate the information was with your start, you're never going to be able to do better than about 2 weeks of weather forecasting. Now, the climate problem is different because the predictability comes from somewhere else. The predictability of climate comes about basically from this understanding of energy, like how much energy is coming in, how much energy is leaving, and what does that do to the temperature. And that's a very different thing than the details of the turbulent motions of the atmosphere. And in fact, it kind of averages over all of those things. So you don't get very good climate estimates for, you know, what's going to happen in 2 years' time or in 3 years' time or in 4 years' time. But you do get a good understanding at about 20 years or 30 years lead time, because then that's enough time for the averages across all of that chaotic behavior to kind of come out in the wash.
Let's take a short break. If you're just joining us, we are talking to Gavin Schmidt. He's one of the world's leading climate scientists and the director of the Goddard Institute of Space Studies in New York. I'm Dave Shlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Stay with us. And we're back. Let's return now to our conversation with Gavin Schmidt. He's one of the world's leading climate scientists and also one of the creators of RealClimate.org, a website that counters the specious claims of climate science denialists. Well, let's talk about some of the things that we are observing in real time. One of the things that really caught my attention was the temperature in the Antarctic reaching 65 degrees. And even though it's summertime down there, that seemed like a very dramatic temperature to me. And, you know, what's going on with Australia with these massive wildfires and the heat down there. And I heard you talking on NPR about this a little bit. And you'd mentioned that in Australia, they had gone through a very mild winter, you know, with a very dry season, nice balmy weather, which people enjoy. And I'm observing the same thing here in Northern California, where we've had zero rainfall now, basically from January through February. It's about 70 degrees outside. It's, you know, it's quote unquote beautiful, but it worries the hell out of me for what's coming in the summer. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, what we observed in Australia?
So I share your concerns completely. So in Australia, the last year that they've had was the warmest year on record. It was also the driest year on record. And those are the two precursors in an environment like Australia, which is kind of similar to the Mediterranean, similar to California. It's a precursor for a large fire problem because the soils are dry, there's a lot of fuel, and there's a lot of wood lying around. So, you know, people at the time were saying, oh, this is so pleasant. You know, we don't want to have a cold winter and it's nice. But these things are connected. You know, the seasonal cycle that we have is part of the climate. It's like it's not, you know, the temperatures in January and February and spring are not unconnected for what happens, you know, later on that year. And so these things do kind of add up. I mean, like right now, you know, the U.S. East Coast is having a record warm winter warmth. You know, we've had almost no snow. It's been remarkably warm. You know, you're seeing spring blooms weeks early, basically all up the U.S. East Coast. And you think, oh, well, that's nice, daffodils. But there will be a frost later on in the year, and things like apples and peaches, they rely on, you know, having an uninterrupted amount of growth. And so when they start too early, they can often get hammered with March or April variability. And so again, you know, people can be in the moment and say, oh, this is so nice. But then if you think about the wider consequences, you know, everything is shifting. And these consequences are actually quite predictable.
Yeah, and our memories are so selective because, you know, I know talking to friends and relatives who have lived here, you know, all their lives. And, oh, you know, I can remember, you know, days in January and February where, you know, it was warm and balmy and, you know, but not lasting the length of time that we're seeing now. It's like, yes, you got a few days of that, you know, four days. Now you're getting a month of it. That's a whole different ballgame.
Exactly right. Yeah. You know, plants and ecosystems and glaciers and, you know, other elements of the system, that they integrate all of that. And so, you know, even if it doesn't seem like it's very much to us with, you know, this kind of very ephemeral view of the weather, the systems underlying a lot of what we rely on are actually shifting under our feet.
I'd like to shift gears a little bit and talk to you about another aspect of your work with the website Real Climate, which I, you know, I've always looked at as a really great resource for, you know, when you hear some kind of, you know, strange climate skepticism about the science of climate, usually coming from some group funded by the petroleum industry or whatever. Could you tell us about your work with Real Climate?
Yeah, it's a little bit odd to be talking about a blog in this day and age of social media. But back when we started, this was in the early 2000s, you know, the notion that that scientists would speak directly to the public without having to go through, you know, the newspapers or the TV or something was I think, still something of a shock to people. And I think it was a precursor of the amazing interactions that you can have now on social media with, you know, people all over the world who are actually at the cutting edge of understanding the problem and doing something about the problem. But this was early on. And so, you know, we started talking about, well, you know, here's our understanding as a scientist and answering questions and talking to the public directly. And it seemed like it was a radical thing. Yeah, working on a blog, you know, was very illuminating, and, you know, understanding better what people didn't understand, what pieces of information were missing. What I've found more and more is that people really don't understand how science works, let alone how climate science or weather forecasting works. They really don't understand how science works, how we use models, how we make predictions, how we evaluate predictions. And so that apprenticeship kind of through the blog and the website, and now, you know, it's kind of gone on to, you know, Twitter and Facebook and all the rest of it. It was a very useful learning period. And, you know, I think people forget, you know, back in the early 2000s, people actually read the comments. And we spent so much time, like, thinking about the comments and responding to the comments. And now, obviously, you don't bother with that anymore.
Yeah, not a good idea. And, you know, you mentioned something that just brought up a word to me about when you talked about people not understanding how science actually works. When you take, you know, physics classes and courses like that, you learn about the concept of uncertainty, you know, as a mathematical tool to use in your work and collecting data and interpreting it. And yet when the general public hears the word uncertainty, that's a completely different message to them.
Yeah. So, I mean, there are a lot of traps there. You know, I talk about radiation and people think about Chernobyl. You know, you talk about models and people think about, pinup. People have, there's this kind of very appropriate but technical language that that scientists use, and then there's this kind of pop understanding of what those words mean. And unless you get past that, unless you really define your terms or avoid them altogether, somebody can be talking and they think everybody understands what they're saying, but in fact they have totally the wrong idea about what it is you're doing. And so really kind of breaking things down to the concepts, breaking things down to other issues that perhaps aren't as politicized as examples, that helps a lot.
Yeah, I'm on vacation this week, but next week it's back to FD cosine theta. So there's an inside joke for you science nerds out there. I'd also like to ask you, in association with your work on real climate, about where we are right now in terms of the merchants of doubt, the science, the skeptics, the people that keep casting doubt on your work. People like Anthony Watts, for example, who happens to be based here in Northern California. Where are we at now with those people compared to where we were, say, back when you started this in the early 2000s?
That is a great question. So these people are not skeptics. I mean, skepticism is a great tradition, and all of the best scientists are arch skeptics of both their own and everybody else's research. What we're talking about here is not skepticism. It's denialism. It's people refusing to understand or not wanting to understand the conclusions that science has come to, and that's a very different thing. But what has happened since the early 2000s? Is that, that's become much less of an issue. Even with, governments that really, really don't want to do anything about this problem, that kind of blatant denial has gone out of favor. And it's gone out of favor because it's obviously wrong. People can see that things are changing. People can see that the sea is rising, that the temperatures are warming, that the fires are getting stronger, that the rainfall is getting stronger, that the ice is melting. There have been so many facts on the ground that make it effectively undeniable to say that something is happening. And you see public opinion has kind of shifted alongside that. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, people were still asking us, so is this global warming? Is that real? And now people are asking us, so how many years do we have left? Which isn't a great question either, but it's a very different question. It's a question that understands that we have been doing something to the climate. And so a lot of those people are kind of always finding a nit to pick or every time you post something, hashtag climate scam or something. Yeah, they are less and less relevant to anything, even though, those individuals, they're not going to change their minds, they're not going to stop doing what they're doing. But they're not, they're not politically salient anymore. And so it's much easier to ignore them the same way that NASA ignores the moon landing hoaxes.
Yeah. And we're seeing a big pushback from young people around the world, like, Greta Thunberg, for example, and people like that in the Sunshine Movement. Sunrise, I'm sorry. Thank you. Thanks for fixing that. We're seeing, a big pushback from the young people around the world that are realizing that, these models and things, these projections, they may not be disastrous for me at age 60, but they will be for them when they're only 15 or 16 years old.
Well, I've spent a little bit of time talking to some of these folk, and what I get from them is a totally understandable frustration that, given that we've known about this problem for 40 years, that we've made good predictions for what was going to happen, and we've understood why these things were changing, and we had opportunities to get onto a better path before bad things started to happen, and that we didn't take those opportunities. What I hear from them is a deep frustration that the powers that be have basically punted on this whole question and look like they're just going to leave it in this next generation's lap without having done anything. And so the kids are going, I don't understand. If you knew what was going to happen, why didn't you do something? And the response from the powers that be has been, oh, yes, well, yes, you're right. We should probably do something. You know, it's not sufficient. And so you end up with this situation where, you know, with the clarity of youth, you can see through the humbug, and you can see things a little clearer than, you know, perhaps us middle-aged folk are want to do.
Yeah, and when you look at, you know, what issues are important to voters, for example, right now we're in an election year here in the United States, they tend to talk about things like healthcare and the economy, and it seems like it's hard for climate change to really, you know, take on the importance that it should have. How big an issue should this be to voters?
Well, I mean, I'm seeing some polls that suggest that that people are actually moving this up on their list of important things much, much more strongly than I perhaps would have imagined. There's a very clear distinction in my mind between, you know, issues that are acute, you know, issues that affect you here and now, and you have to stop everything to deal with them, like a medical emergency, your job, the economy. All of these things are felt very acutely by people, and so it's obviously these are things that are uppermost in people's thoughts. But people are also seeing the acute manifestations of a chronic problem like climate change. You know, so the chronic problem is that sea level is increasing because of the ice melting and the water warming, but that's leading to these a much greater amount of coastal flooding, and the coastal flooding is going up exponentially. And so it's getting to the point where that slow process that we've been talking about that didn't seem so urgent is having these acute impacts that are kind of connecting the dots for people and then making them feel that this is a topic or an issue that should be higher in the political conversation. And I think we're seeing that in the polling with the upcoming election too.
Yeah, and I just saw some research out of UC Davis today by some economists talking about, you know, these climate change issues as they start to unfold more and more, and they already have been with wildfires and droughts and, you know, heavy rainfall events, things like that. That these are things that can trigger recessions. They're not something that you can ignore as not being part of the economy.
Right. I mean, this notion that the economy was separate from the environment, I think, is a very, kind of 1960s notion. I don't think people think that anymore. I think people see a functioning and healthy environment is the sine qua non of having a worthwhile economy. There's no point in delivering massive amounts of shareholder value if there's nobody here to enjoy it.
You're listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Sloan. Let's take a short break, but when we return, we'll continue our conversation with the director of NASA's Goddard Institute of Space Studies in New York, Gavin Schmidt. Dr. Schmidt is one of the leading experts on the science of climate change and the computer modeling that is used to forecast the future of our warming planet.
Thank you.
And we're back. And thanks for listening. Let's return now to our conversation with NASA climate scientist Gavin Schmidt. I'm Dave Schlom, and you are listening to Blue Dot. Let's go back to the science stuff, because that's always the focus I like to keep us on.
And it's what I know. So
that's... Yeah. But I do appreciate you talking about these other issues, because, you know, this is where science and society really do collide with this issue, perhaps more than any other. But I'd like to ask you about how you've seen the evolution of being able to collect data working for NASA, because with NASA and NOAA, you know, we are able to collect so much more information about the planet than when you probably first started your work. Could you comment on that a bit?
Oh, absolutely. And it's truly impressive. You know, we have, you know, dozens of satellites in low Earth orbit that are taking measurements and reporting back variables like how thick the ozone is, what the temperature is at all the different layers, how fast the winds are at the surface, how much moisture there is, how many aerosols there are, how many little particles, you know, how much ice there is, how many clouds, what kinds of clouds, what height of clouds, understand what color the ocean is, which tells you something about the biology and the carbon cycle, how the trees are growing, how green are the trees. All of these things are being measured by satellites. And they're all telling us something very, very interesting about how the whole system works together. And that's led to, you know, improvements of our understanding. It's led to improvements in the models. It's led to improvements in the predictions, not just for the climate, but also for the weather. And maintaining this and making it even better is what NASA and NOAA and the Europeans and the Japanese are working. You know, pretty tirelessly on doing. It really is a very, very impressive endeavor. And it's something that, you know, these satellites are expensive. You know, they're 100 million, 200 million plus for each kind of launch, and then maintaining them it's not cheap. But they pay for themselves, you know, in spades.
Yeah, and not too long ago, I saw a certain politician, I don't want to mention who it is, but talking about how, oh, well, NASA should be not focusing on that stuff, but, you know, going out and exploring space with astronauts and going back to the moon or Mars and da-da-da, as if that needs to be, it needs to be either or. But it reminded me of, you know, the big jewel of the Apollo missions was the look back at Earth and the realization that, you know, we live on this fragile planet. And all of the Apollo astronauts commented on that when they saw the Earth from lunar orbit over that desolate lunar landscape, they realized how precious this living planet is. And, you know, that's, to me, you know, should be one of NASA's greatest missions, is, you know, studying the Earth from space and giving us that planetary perspective.
Perspective is exactly the right answer. You know, we're looking at, you know, the climates of other planets. You know, we're trying to work out what Mars was like, you know, early in the life of the solar system, what Venus was like early in the life of the solar system, what these new exoplanets that we're now detecting around, you know, other suns, other stars. And what you find is that, yeah, our understanding of what's happening on Earth is informing how we're able to understand what's happening on these other planets, on these other, around these other stars. But we're also able to see how special the Earth is, and how lucky we've been as a planet and as a species to live on a planet that has been viable for life for so long, and hopefully for a lot longer.
Well, when you talk to, you know, friends and relatives who are not scientists, what are some of the things that that sometimes you get asked that are the biggest misconceptions people have about your work?
You know, people don't really understand how we do the modeling. You know, people think that, you know, you draw a bunch of lines, a bunch of dots on a graph, and you draw a straight line through it, and that's what we do. And you know, the notion that you know, we're trying to model all these different processes, and then, you know, these great animations that you see show all of these things kind of working together. People don't realize what it is that we're doing, but you can show them these great visuals that I think help bring it home to people, you know. And you know that, and then, you know, people think that you know, we haven't looked at everything. You know, it's, oh well, what about the sun? Well, we've looked at the sun. You know, what about the ice ages? Oh well, we look at the ice ages a lot. What about you know, the dinosaurs, and it was so hot during the dinosaur period. It's like, well, yeah, we've looked at all those things too. You know, I mean, people don't have a very deep view of what it is that that climate science has done and does. And so one of my funnest things is really, you know, introducing people to, you know, the wealth of information and data that we have from all these different time periods, from all these different measurements, from all these different planets, and showing that it is, in fact, you know, a coherent body of work, and it is a, you know, and we do understand things to a reasonable extent.
Yes. And you know, one of you just made me think of something. You hear this argument quite a lot. It's like, well, the climate's always been changing, and you know, how do we know that, you know, we're the major factor here? And but yet the data, when you know, that we're talking about here, and the model agreement shows that, you know, it is us. And the most interesting thing to me is it's the pace. It's the pace that this is happening at compared to what we've observed in the past in you know, geologic time.
Right. You know, I mean, so yes, I mean, the climate has always changed. And how do you know that? Well, that's because climate scientists have told you. And we know that there's a thousand different ways that you can change the climate. You know, we know that it changed radically when there was a massive asteroid that also wiped out the dinosaurs. We've known that it changes as the continents move around. We know that it changes because of the wobbles in the Earth's orbit, you know, that caused the ice ages to wax and wane. And we can look at what's happened over the 20th century, and we can see there hasn't been an asteroid. The Earth's orbit has not wobbled. There haven't been, you know, a total absence of volcanoes. The sun hasn't changed that much. And we go tick, 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 tick. Let's look at this. Let's look at that. Let's look at that. And then we look at the things that humans have done. And we say, okay, well, look, we've increased these really important greenhouse gases. We've chopped down forests. We've changed the surface of the planet. We've produced lots of air pollution. That's changed how the sun interacts with the climate. And we put all of these things together. And what you find is that the trends of the last 100 years, last 60 years, they're all due to us. These things would not have happened if only the natural parts of the climate system had been operating, right? It needs our input to have pushed it into this new place. And that's dramatic, and people often don't like to hear that, but it doesn't stop it from being true.
Yeah, well, that's, you know, like any bad diagnosis, the truth is what it is, and it's up to you as the patient to deal with it and make changes. Before we let you go, what are some of the most interesting challenges for you, you know, moving forward in terms of your work? Like, what are some of the big questions you have that you're trying to answer in producing the next generation of climate models?
Well, we're looking particularly at what we call feedbacks, you know, kind of things that might amplify the problem or make it less of a problem. But mainly they're things that are amplifying the problem. And I'll pick out two. One is, you know, what's really happening to the ice sheets in Antarctica. You mentioned that there were some record warm temperatures the last week around Antarctica, and we've seen some massive mass loss from the glaciers and ice shelves and ice sheets in Antarctica just recently, but over the last 30 years. And it turns out that those ice sheets are being melted from below. So the water is warming, and then that warm water is kind of coming underneath the ice and melting it from below. And those are changing things in Antarctica in ways that we really don't understand. You know, we've only just really seen the first maps for what the land looks like underneath the ice. We've only just seen the first sets of information for what's happening underneath the ice shelves, where, you know, up until now, we've not been able to send instruments. We didn't even know what the shape of those cavities were. But we're getting a lot more information now, where our understanding of how ice dynamics works is improving. We're getting a lot more information from satellites, but both in situ data, and then trying to put that together to make credible estimates of how the ice sheets are going to change in a warming climate. That's really one of the key frontiers. And then there's one other one, which is the carbon cycle feedbacks. The fact that, you know, as the permafrost in the Arctic melts, there's a lot of carbon that's being released. Is that carbon going to be released into the atmosphere? How fast is it going to be released into the atmosphere? Does that then cause more warming that causes more melting of the permafrost? Like, how big an effect is that? We know that there's an effect, but really trying to pin it down so that we can improve the predictions, you know, going out 30, 40, 50 years is really one of the key questions that we have to deal with going forward.
Can you give me a sense of how long it takes when you start to develop one of your computer models? How long does it take to like run some of these computer programs on supercomputers to start to tease out this information? How much time is involved in that?
So that's a very interesting question, because the answer is it hasn't changed in 40 years. We basically run the models so that they do something like 5 model years per day. Right. So, you know, in a month, you could do 150 years. Right. So so that's, you know, people want to do from the 19th and 19th century out to 2100. You know, so that's like a 2-month simulation on a supercomputer. And it used to be 2 months, you know, 20 years ago, and 20 years before that, it used to be 2 months as well. But what we've done is, you know, as the computing power has increased, we've made things more complicated. We've put in more details, we've put in more variables, but we're always kind of like going at the same rate, because it turns out that's the rate at which you can do real science. If it goes much slower than that, you can't explore the uncertainties, and if it goes much faster than that, you feel that you're missing important aspects of the problem that you should be looking at. So it takes about 2 months to do a new simulation. It takes much longer than that to get to the point where you can do a new simulation, because you need to test all of this new physics, you need to test all of these new components, and that takes years and many, many people working on it.
Yeah, well, that's interesting. But before we let you go, what's your favorite part of your job?
That's a great question. You know, when I was a mathematician, nobody would really want to talk to me. You know, you tell people that, at a party, say, and they'd ask you what you do, and you say, "Oh, I'm a mathematician," and then that would pretty much be the end of the conversation. And now, you know, I tell people, "Oh, well, you know, I'm a climate scientist. I work for NASA," and you know, people are fascinated. People really want to understand what we're doing, and so as my kind of academic journey has gone from basic irrelevance to being of something, doing something that's extremely salient. I enjoy enormously being able to share what we've learned, not just me personally, but as a community, because it is important. It does matter. And, you know, and it is a good use of our time and energy and money to be studying these things. And when people are interested in what we do, and not just out of intellectual curiosity, but that's good as well, but because it actually matters, that really brings it home that what it is that we're doing is worthwhile.
Well, and you're very good at communicating it. I must say, I've thoroughly enjoyed talking to you and learning about the climate system from you, and your work and how it works is fascinating to me, because a lot of us just have really no idea that, you know, we know you're a climate scientist, but, you know, what do you do? How do you do it? And, you know, how do you know the things you know? And you're very good at communicating that. So thank you for that.
Oh, thank you for giving me the chance to show off.
And, you know, your story reminded me of when I was teaching chemistry, and you'd go to a party and somebody would say, well, what do you teach? And I'd say chemistry, and they'd go, oh, I hated that subject, and they walk away. So after a while, I learned say, art. Yeah, I teach art. I'll just lie so you'll talk to me.
My wife teaches chemistry, and so I feel that quite strongly.
Well, Gavin, thanks a lot, and best of luck to you in the future. Keep up the good work, and thanks for spending this time with us.
You're welcome. I'm very happy to do so.
Thanks once again to our guest, Gavin Schmidt, the director of NASA's Goddard Institute of Space Studies in New York. Gavin is one of the climate scientists that I most respect, and you don't need to be a climate scientist to notice how our weather patterns are and have been changing dramatically. Here in Northern California, where this show is produced, we started out with a promising winter of incoming storms that started to build up our snowpack in the Northern Sierra and Cascade Mountains. But then, after December 26th, it all stopped. For 2 months now, we've had unusually warm and dry weather, and every time someone comments to me that it is a beautiful day, I can't help but feel a sense of unease, knowing that this summer, this dry weather will create extreme fire danger and the attendant public safety power shutoffs that have become the inconvenient truth of the new norm in California. It's an election year, and for me, climate change is the most important issue that I will use to choose for whomever I vote for. Because a future that is predicted by the accurate climate models that the scientific community around the world has made clear to us is truly a threat to our very existence. That's what existential means. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can revisit this and past episodes at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to our podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is produced and engineered by the maestro, Matt Fiddler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.